So today's the last lecture, and what I'm going to talk about is adding quarks as different groups. Where by quarks, I mean matter in the fundamental representation. Of course, the motivation for doing this is that QCD does have quarks in the fundamental representation, and we want to construct models that have that type of matter. So let me go back to the very beginning when we talked about the decoupling limit and we motivated the duality between n equals 4 super young Mills and string theory in empty Sitter space. And we'll do the same thing. We'll take again the same limit, but with a slight modification, adding new degrees of freedom on both sides, and we'll end up with a correspondence between a theory now with quarks and a theory with D-brain probes in empty Sitter space. So if you remember, what we did was to consider a stack of NC D3s. And we argued that this system had two equivalent descriptions. This description here, in which we thought of the brains as living in flat space and we ignored the back reaction and the curvature around them, if you remember, this one was good when GSNC was much smaller than 1. And this one here, because the radius of the throat R, if you remember, R to the fourth over LS to the fourth, this was proportional to GS and C. So this description was good when GS and C was very large. And then we looked at the degrees of freedom excitations around the ground state on this side. And we argued that we have closed strings and open strings. And I'm going to call these strings 3-3 strings because they start and end on D3 brains. So these are open 3-3 strings. Whereas on this side, we had closed strings propagating in the asymptotically flat region, and also closed strings propagating down the throat. And then if you remember, we took a decoupling limit in which we looked at energies much smaller than 1 over LS. OK, very low energies compared to the string scale. And then we argued that on this side, we obtained two decoupled sectors. One of them was non-interacting closed strings in Minkowski in 10 dimensions. So three closed strings in M10, plus D equals 4, N equals 4, SUNC, super young Mills, interacting with coupling G squared young Mills proportional to GS. And these two sectors were decoupled from each other. And here, for the same, in the same limit, we also argued that this guy is decoupled from these guys because this find it very hard at long wavelengths to feel the presence of the throat. And these ones find it very hard to climb up the throat and interact with these ones. And also at low energies, these ones, because we're taking low energies with respect to an observer at infinity, these ones become free because gravity or closed strings at low energies are, the interaction is proportional to the energy to some power. So these ones, so here we obtained, again, three closed strings in Minkowski in 10 dimensions. And however, for these guys, we argue that we have to keep all the tower of states because even if you have a very high energy down here, that can still look like a very low energy to an observer at infinity. So here we conserved the entire tower of string modes. And so we got string theory, type 2b to be precise, string theory on ADS5 crosses 5. Okay? And these two sectors are decoupled as well. So if these two descriptions are the same, then by comparing, this bit obviously is the same as this bit. So we concluded, or we motivated, that this, we conjectured that this has to be equivalent to this. Okay? So now let me repeat this argument, but introducing new degrees of freedom. The reason I'm doing this is because I want to obtain now the string description of n equals 4 super Young Mills plus matter in the fundamental representation. Okay, this theory only has matter, fermions, and scalars in the adjoint. So I'm going to enlarge the theory by coupling it to an additional sector. In order to do that, I have to introduce new degrees of freedom, obviously on both sides. So what I'm going to do is to now consider that I take the same decoupling limit, but in the presence of NF, where F stands for flavor now, the number of these guys will tell me how many quark species I have. NF, these seven brains. And in about 10 minutes, I'll be more precise about how these seven brains are oriented and so on. But for the moment, all I want you to note is that by doing this, and by the way, I will consider NF to be much smaller than NC. One reason I'm doing this is because if you remember when we took the large NC limit in the gauge theory, I said we are taking NC to infinity, but we will keep NF fixed. Okay? So in the large N limit, I want to consider NF much smaller than NC. So let's look at the new degrees of freedom we have introduced on this side. Now I have, of course, I have 7 strings, just like I had before, open strings ending on the D3s. And now I have strings that can stretch from one to the other. So these are called 3-7 strings. Now remember, the reason that the closed strings at low energy is decoupled and become free is because their interaction strength is governed by Newton's constant times e to the a, which goes to zero in this limit. Now, for these guys, the interaction between 7-7 strings with themselves, that's controlled by the coupling constant on the D7 brains. Remember, the coupling constant on the D3 brains is G squared Young Mills. And because the D3 brains are 3 plus 1 dimensional, the Young Mills coupling in 3 plus 1 dimensions is dimensionless. Okay? And that's why when I take a low energy limit, it doesn't go to zero because it's already dimensionless. I don't have to multiply it by a power of the energy. However, for these guys, the coupling on the D7 brains, G squared, this has dimensions of length squared because it's the Young Mills coupling in 8 dimensions, 7 plus 1 dimensions. Is this clear to everybody? These open strings live on a 7 plus 1 dimensional world volume because the only condition on them is that they have to be attached to a 7 plus 1 dimensional hypersurface. Okay? So at low energies, the coupling constant that governs these interactions is the Young-Mills coupling constant in 7 plus 1 dimensions. And if you write down the kinetic term for gauge fields in 7 plus 1 dimensions, you'll discover that it has dimensions of length squared. And so the dimensionless coupling is G squared E squared, okay? Because I have to get something dimensionless. And of course, when I send the energy to zero, this goes to zero, okay? So these guys also give me a free sector. So here, in this case, now I get 3 closed strings in 10 dimensions plus 3, 7, 7 in 8 dimensions. But also I have to consider these ones. Now, these ones, if you notice, have one endpoint on the D3s and one endpoint on the D7s. So they couple both to these guys and to these guys. All right? The coupling to these guys is controlled by the coupling constant on the D3 brains, which, as we saw, this is G squared, where I'm calling G squared Young-Mills. As we saw, this is dimensionless. So this remains finite. But their coupling to these ones goes to zero because they couple to these ones with the same coupling as these ones couple to themselves. OK? So at low energies, what I get from these guys is that they give me an additional interacting sector of degrees of freedom coupled to the 3-3 strings, which gave me this n equals 4 super Young-Mills multiplet. OK? Now, what type of degrees of freedom are these guys? Well, the reason why here I get all the matter in the adjoint representation, remember, the adjoint representation is represented by fields that have two color indices. Yes? Why do they have two color indices here? Because the 3-3 strings have both endpoints on the D3s. Okay? This SUNC gauge symmetry is associated to the D3s. So if you have objects with both endpoints on them, each of the endpoints carries an index. Okay? It's a Champ pattern factor, if you like, if you've ever heard of this. However, these ones only have one index, and that's why they transform in the fundamental representation. Okay? This is the intuition. Is this clear? So these ones give me NF flavors, if you like, of quarks, in quotation marks. And the reason I'm putting it in quotation marks, so this is coupled to this, is because when you quantize these strings, not only you get fermions, spin a half fermions, but also scalars in the fundamental representation. So in QCD, you only have fermions in the fundamental. In this model, you have both fermions and scalars in the fundamental. But that's still a step forward in the direction of approaching QCD. Okay, what we would really like is just to introduce fermions, and that can be done, but not in a simple model. So in this simple model, that's why I'm putting quarks in quotation marks. But that's not going to be too important. Okay, the important thing is that we know how to incorporate matter in the fundamental. Okay. And why do I get NF flavors of them? Because these strings also carry an index over here. Okay, and if I have NF D7 brains, then what I'm saying is that I have an index A that labels on what D7 brain I'm attached, and a color index I that tells me in what representation of SUN I transform. Okay? So for each NF, for each D7 brain, I get one of these quarks. If I have NF of them, I get NF objects, each of them with a color index. Yes? For example, can somebody tell me in QCD what NF is? Six. We have six species of quarks, okay? Very good. So these guys, in fact, in addition to transforming in the fundamental of the gauge group, this theory has a global, not a gauge, but a global symmetry that's UNF that rotates all these quarks amongst themselves. Okay? In QCD, for example, if all the quarks had equal mass, say if all of them were massless, QCD would have a U6 symmetry that rotates all the quarks amongst themselves. Okay? That's broken because they have different masses. But if they had... Very good. In fact, here, I should be talking about U and C as well. But when you take the decoupling limit and you replace this by the geometry, what you do is you freeze the overall U1. So UN at the level, at least locally, is U1 cross SUN. Yes? This U1 corresponds to the overall center of mass of the D3s. And when you take the decoupling limit and you replace it by a geometry, you choose, you freeze the degree of freedom because you say they are sitting over here, the center of mass. Of course, they can fluctuate, but the center of mass is here. And then I'm going to study the dynamics. When I replace them by a geometry here, for example, I'm assuming that they are sitting where the throat is. So this is a subtle issue in ADS-CFT. So let me leave it there. And if you're interested, we can discuss it at the end more. OK. So this is what we get on this side. We get this free sector decoupled from this interacting sector. Okay? Now, let's now just look at what we get on this side. And then by comparing, we will see what this corresponds to. Okay? So I told you that NF is much smaller than NC. So when I incorporate, when I replace the D3 brains by their supergravity solution, by their back reaction on space-time, I don't need to do the same with the D7 brains because I have very few of them. So I'm going to ignore their back reaction and just treat them as a probe. This is the same as saying that I'm going to study the dynamics of the Earth moving around the Sun by considering that the space-time is the result of the back reaction of the mass of the Sun, but I'm not going to incorporate the correction coming from the mass of the Earth. Why? Because the Earth is so much lighter than the Sun. So that's a very good approximation, okay? Or a satellite moving around the Sun. So here what I'm saying is I have a very large number of D3 brains, a huge number. In fact, I'm taking NC to infinity. And I have a finite number of these ones. So of course, the back reaction of these ones dominates, okay? So then I treat them as a test probe. But now that D7 brain in this description, here, these D7s live in flat space. But here, when I incorporate the back reaction, they live in a curved geometry. Okay, so this is a D7, the NF D7 brains that now live in a geometry that asymptotically is flat space, but near the origin, so to speak, develops this throat. So what additional degrees of freedom do I have now? Well, I have, just like before I had closed strings in the asymptotic region and closed strings in the throat, now I have 7-7 strings in the asymptotic region and 7-7 strings down the throat. Okay? Now, for the same reason as here, when I take the energy to zero, this sector, because it lives in asymptotically flat space, and I'm taking the energy to zero, they decouple. They become free, and they don't interact with these ones or with these ones, okay? Because of this reason, because g squared on the D7 brain times the energy squared goes to zero, okay? But exactly, again, for the same reason that down here I had to keep all the infinite tower of closed string modes, I also have to keep all the infinite tower of 7-7 strings, yes? So again, what we get is two decoupled sectors here. We get this one and this one. And if you look at this one, you see it's exactly the same again as this one. Because we added a free sector on both sides. But this one now, therefore, should be equivalent or dual to this one. Okay? So now the statement, the conclusion that I want you to take away from this is the following. You start with a theory that has no degrees of freedom in the fundamental representation, no quarks. If you are interested in studying this theory at large NC with a small number of flavors, okay, small number of quarks, one way to do that is to take the geometry that you started with, you know, the string dual to the theory without quarks. So in that geometry now, you place NF D-brain probes of a different type, the ones you started with. And then the idea is that the closed strings, these closed strings are dual to gauge invariant states, color singlets here, constructed only with glue or adjoint matter. Okay? So these are glue ball like states. Whereas now, if I have quarks, I can also construct meson like states or baryons. Okay, let's focus on mesons which are simpler at large n. So the meson-like states are quark-anti-quark bound states. Those are dual to these guys. The 7-7 strings correspond to meson, namely QQ bar bound states. Okay, I'm going to be a little bit more precise about this in a second. But for example, yesterday I was talking about the global spectrum in this confining theory that we constructed, remember? And I said there is a mass gap and we can look for normalizable modes by looking at fluctuations of the dilaton. and that tells us about the spectrum of gluons. If I want to do the same thing now to calculate the meson spectrum, what I have to do is to look at small fluctuations of the D7 brains living in this throat, look for normalizable modes, regular normalizable modes, and those give me the meson spectrum. And if I have time, I'll give you an example today, if I get to that. Is this clear now? OK. One reason I'm spending some time here is because this argument, this decoupling limit in the presence of additional brains, is usually not discussed. So OK. So let me be a little bit more precise. Are there any questions about this? No? Oh. A bit more precise about the way we are introducing these D7 brains. So the idea is that we started with NCD3 brains that span the one, let's say, the 1, 2, 3 directions and time. Okay? So let's put it like this. 6, 7, 8, 9. So of the 10 dimensions in type 2B string theory, they only span the 0, 1, 2, 3 directions. And now we are adding NFP7 brains. And we will add them along the 0, 1, 2, 3. So they share all the directions of the gauge theory. But they also extend along 4, 5, 6, 7. OK? So this would be the 1, 2, 0, 1, 2, 3. And then the, well, actually, let me draw a slightly different picture. So I'm going to draw a picture of this system in which I'm going to suppress the 0, 1, 2, 3 directions. I'm not going to draw them because they are common to all of them. Everything is translationally invariant along the 0, 1, 2, 3 directions. Okay? So if you want, you can imagine that those directions are coming out from the board. But I'm not drawing them. Let me draw the transverse directions, which are the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 directions. Okay? So the D7 brains look like this. This direction here would be 8, 9. And then these directions would be, say, 4, 5, and 6, 7. OK, so the D7 extends along 4, 5, 6, 7. And these ones, which, as I said, I'm suppressing. This point here, coming out from the board, if you like, would be the 0, 1, 2, 3 directions. The 8, 9 directions are orthogonal to both the 3 brains and the 7 brains. So you should think of the D3s, if you like, as sitting at this point. Okay, and they are a point because I'm suppressing these directions. And then there are some directions that are filled out by the 7 brains, the 4, 5, 6, 7. And the 8, 9 are orthogonal to both of them. The reason I'm emphasizing this is because this means that I can actually separate the 7 brains from the 3 brains. They don't need to intersect. Even though at the beginning I drew a picture in which that suggests that they are intersecting, they don't have to. OK? So now, these directions here, if you notice, there are 6 of them, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. When you replace the 3 brains by their supergravity solution, this 6 directions give you, you can think of them as the radial direction and the S5. Okay? When you write the metric sourced by the 3 brains, which is this one again, okay, this 0, 1, 2, 3 directions are these ones. And that's why we think of them as the gauge theory directions. And the radial direction together with the S5 correspond to the 6 directions transverse to the 3 brains. Is this intuition clear? So this means that the seven brains here are wrapping, if you like, a radial direction, rho, and a three sphere, as you can see from here. So if you draw a sphere around this point, that's a five sphere. Okay, and the seven brains are actually, you can think of them as a radial direction rho together with an S3. This S3 is the intersection of this S5 with this hyperplane. Yes? If you draw a big S5, this would be the intersection. So we're going to call this direction, the radial direction in the 8-9 plane, we'll call that Z. Rho is the radial direction in the 4-5-6-7 directions, or hyperplane. And then R is, of course, this R that appears here is rho squared plus Z squared. Is it clear what I'm doing? I'm using polar coordinates in the 8-9 directions, and I'm only drawing the radial direction, Z, and then spherical coordinates in the 4-5-6-7 4 space, and the radial direction is rho, and then R is the overall radial direction in the 4-5-6-7-8-9 space, okay? Very good. So now you see this distance, let's call that L, the distance, the separation between the point at which the seven brains are sitting and the origin, okay? So the seven brains are sitting at Z equals L. This distance determines the quark mass. Why? Because remember that I told you the quarks come from the 3-7 strings. Remember this? Okay? So if I give a minimum length to the 3-7 strings, I'm giving a mass to the quarks. Is this clear? I know it's Friday and everybody's tired. I'm tired too, but if it's not clear, please tell me. Okay. What I'm saying is that the quarks in the gauge theory come from quantizing the 3-7 strings. These are the guys that give me degrees of freedom that only have one endpoint, one index, one color index. Okay? So if I now separate the three brains from the seven brains, what I'm doing is I'm forcing the 3-7 strings to have a minimum length. Okay? When they fluctuate, they can have a higher energy, but at least they need to have an energy that's their tension times this distance. Okay? So the mass of the quark is given by the tension of the string times L, which is L divided by 2 pi alpha prime. Okay? So the interpretation of this geometric parameter in the string description, when you translate it into the gauge theory, that fixes the quark mass.
Mm-hmm. Say if you didn't want all the quarks to have the same mass.
Good enough. Yes, of course. Here I'm all the time talking about either you can think of it as either a single seven brain or multiple seven brains that I'm taking to be overlapping. But I could separate, I could add now a second seven brain up here at a different distance, and then one quark would have a mass L1 over 2 pi alpha prime, the second one would be L2 over 2 pi alpha prime, and so on.
And these all remain as three parameters?
Yes, very good. They remain three parameters because this distance, if I were to add temperature, you would see much more clearly, but I'm not going to have time. But the point is that this distance is actually a non-normalizable mode in this system. Okay? Maybe I'll have time to say something about this, but the point is that here the brain can bend and do funny things. You have to look for the minimum area configuration. But asymptotically, when you go very far away, that's a boundary condition. So L is really the asymptotic distance when you go far away from this hyperplane and the origin. And that's something that corresponds to a non-normalizable mode, so that you have to fix, that doesn't fluctuate. You fix that, and then you integrate, you go back over the rest. but the non-horizontal modes are fixed. So it corresponds. Remember, in the second lecture, I think I was talking about adding sources in the gauge theory. A quark mass, you can think of as deforming your action by adding these terms. Yes? OK? So this is a source for this operator. And remember, sources are something you specify, you fix it, and they don't fluctuate. And then you, for example, from the dynamics, determine the packing expectation value, right, as a function of the force mass. So this is something that you have the right to fix. So yes, they are three parameters. Very good. So now, if you take this metric, this is a 10-dimensional metric, okay? If you use this to now compute the induced metric on the word volume of the 7 grains, this sentence makes sense to everybody. If I give you a space-time and a hypersurface, you know that the space-time metric induces a metric on the hypersurface. Okay? So if you compute this induced metric in terms of this raw coordinate, you get the following thing. You get, of course, that 7 plus 1 dimensional metric, because it's a 7 plus 1 dimensional hypersurface, that looks like rho squared plus L squared over R squared minus dt squared plus dx squared plus R squared over rho squared plus L squared d rho squared plus R squared rho squared over rho squared plus L squared d omega 3 squared. Okay, this is because the 7 grains wrap a 3 sphere, and then you have the radial direction and these 0, 1, 2, 3 directions. Okay? The reason I'm writing this down is not because I enjoy writing down long metrics, but because I want to point out a couple of very important aspects that you can see from this metric. So you see the radius of the... So what I'm going to do is to draw a different picture from this one so that you get an intuition from a different point of view. So remember that we have this picture of ADS in which this was the radial direction, I equals infinity was the boundary, or the UV, R equals 0 was the horizon, or the infrared. And now you see this 7 brain, and by the way, here at each point, there is an S5. Okay. Of constant radius, because the space-time metric is a constant R squared. Yes? This is the space-time metric. This is a picture of ADS5 across S5. ADS5 across S5. Okay? Now, what does the 7 brain geometry look like? Well, you see, the 7 brain wraps a 3 sphere inside the S5, which, when rho goes to infinity, this factor goes to R squared. And so this 3 sphere is equatorial, it's a maximum 3 sphere inside the pi sphere at infinity. But as you move down, towards smaller values of rho, the size of the free sphere decreases. Okay? And at rho equals 0, which remember R squared was rho squared plus z squared. So rho equals 0 corresponds to R equals z, which at rho equals 0 corresponds to R equals L. This free sphere goes to 0 size. Okay? So here, it's decreasing in size. And then when you reach a certain value of R, it has shrunk to 0 size. So this means that the 7 brain only extends down to a minimum value of R. Of course, because I told you that it's seated at Z equals L, which corresponds at rho equals 0, corresponds to R equals L. Okay? So this position here is R equals L or rho equals 0. So the seventh grain fills up a portion of anti-de space from a certain minimum radius all the way up to infinity. Okay? And the geometry on the sphere looks like a big sphere here, a smaller sphere here, and a point here. So it looks like this. That's why this geometry closes off at this point. Yes? OK. So I'm saying all of this because now I want to extract some physics from this. First of all, you see that the seven brain only extends down to a minimum radius. Why is this? This is because the quarks that we have added have a mass proportional to L. Okay? So in the gauge theory, if you think about what the physics looks like at different energy scales, if you are at energy scales way below the quark mass, then these quark masses essentially have no impact on the dynamics. If you're looking at, let me write it down. Okay. So this is energy scale, and this is MQ. We started with a theory that had no scales. It was N equals 4 conformal field theory. And we have introduced one scale, which is the quark mass. Okay? So what I'm saying is that if I'm at energies much, much below the quark mass, then I don't expect the quarks to have an effect on the dynamics down here because they are too heavy. Okay? See, I'm doing scattering, for example, at these energies. I'm not going to be able to excite these guys. Okay? So I should expect the physics down here. Remember, low energies corresponds to going to a small radius. So the physics down here should be more or less insensitive to the presence of the seven brains. Okay? That's why they terminate at this point. Please tell me if you're understanding what I'm saying or not.
Mostly.
Mostly? Or okay, what is not clear then? Why is it not 100%? So the theory I started with was conformal, but now I introduce new degrees of freedom with a scale, with a mass. So I'm saying that at energies way below that scale, I'm not going to be able to excite those degrees of freedom, so they will have a very small effect. And that's why here, down here, if you do scattering of gravitons down here, they are going to find it really hard to know that up here there's a seven brain. Okay? Very good.
These are all excited.
For example, down here, that's the point. Down here, the only excitation modes that I have available are closed streams. Okay? No quarks or mesons down here. I have to go to scales according to the quark mass to start seeing that I have additional degrees of freedom.
Okay.
Okay? That's the idea. You also see that in this metric, if you set L to 0, okay, if you push the seven brain all the way down, that corresponds to setting the quark mass to 0. Remember, the quark mass is proportional to this distance. Okay? What happens to this metric if I set L to 0? If I set L to 0, this metric becomes exactly ADS5 cross S3. Okay? You can check it. That you recover exactly the same thing as up here, but with a free sphere instead of a five sphere. So remember that having an exact ABS space geometry corresponds to having an exact conformal symmetry in the gauge theory. Remember that the isometries of anti-de space are exactly the conformal transformations in the gauge theory. So when L is non-zero, this is not exactly ABS, which means that the conformal symmetry is broken. Of course, because I introduced a quark mass. But if I set now the quark mass to zero, I recover an exact ADS isometry and therefore an exact conformal symmetry. Because I started with a conformal theory and I added mass distribution between them, in which case I don't break the conformal symmetry, at least at the leading order. Okay? And then the final comment is that even if you don't set L to zero, if you look at this metric at rho going to infinity up here, you can see that it is approximately in asymptotes to this. Okay, in the interior, it is not. But as you go to larger and larger values of rho, the geometry becomes closer and closer to an exact ADS 5 versus 3 geometry. Why? Because if I go to energies that are way, way bigger than the scale I introduced to break conformal invariance, when I go to energies way above that, the conformal invariance I introduced becomes, its effect becomes smaller and smaller. Let me say this again. Take a theory with no scales, okay? And now introduce a scale by hand, thereby breaking the conformal symmetry, the scale symmetry. Okay? Say that scale is one electron volt. If I'm now looking at the energy at the Planck mass, at the theory of the Planck mass, the fact that I introduced a tiny, tiny, tiny little scale of one electron volt doesn't matter. The theory is essentially scale invariant again. Is this intuition clear? Yes? Okay. So therefore, I should expect that if I go to values of the radial coordinate way above the scale at which I broke conformal invariance, I should recover conformal invariance. And that's what happens. This metric, when rho goes to infinity, asymptotes to this. Okay. And then let me make one more comment. You note that this geometry closes off at the final value of R. Okay? So now suppose that I wanted to compute in this theory the measurement spectrum. Yesterday we talked about how we would compute, not in full detail, but how in principle we would compute the global spectrum. Okay? And what I told you was that you have to think of an operator that acting on the vacuum had the right quantum numbers to create a global. Then look for the field that's dual to that operator in the string description. This is in the gauge theory. Then you identify the dual field, which is the dilator. You look for regular and normalizable solutions of the dilator of this form. And then you discover that this h of r, which is the radial profile, only has normalizable and regular solutions for a discrete set of values of p, or p squared, rather. Okay? And these values are precisely you identify with the masses of the blue balls. Everybody remembers this? Okay. But the key point to conclude that the spectrum was discrete and gapped, remember, was that we had a geometry, we were looking at the confining phase, and we had a geometry, remember, where the white circle shrank to zero size. Because once that happens, in order to find solutions, you have to impose regularity here and normalizability at infinity. And the fact that you're imposing two conditions, that's what discretizes the spectrum, as in quantum mechanics. If you have a wave function that has, say you have a one-dimensional problem, and you impose one condition on one side and another condition on the other side, only for certain values of the energy, you can actually, the one that satisfies the condition over here evolves to the one that satisfies the condition you want over there. Okay? So, but for that, it's crucial that you have a point in the interior at which you have to impose regularity. So now suppose that I want to do the same thing for mesons, okay? Not for blue balls, but for mesons. For example, I'm thinking of an operator like this one. This will give me something that will look like a meson, okay? Because I'm acting on the vacuum with an operator constructed out of two, a quark and an antiquark. So what do I have to do to identify the meson spectrum. Well, I have to find the field that's dual to this guy. Okay, let's call it little phi. Okay, now this field, it doesn't matter very much right now what it is, but what we do know is that this field now doesn't propagate in this metric. This is a 10-dimensional metric. It propagates in this one. In other words, this field lives on the set of rings. Why is this? Because remember, these degrees of freedom, these quarks and antiquarks, this correspond to the 3-7 strings, remember? So these degrees of freedom necessarily have one leg on the 7 strings. In fact, to be more precise, remember that when we concluded that on this side we had 3-7 strings, and I told you on the other side you have this throat and a 7 brain sitting there, and these 7-7 strings here, okay, these are the ones dual to meson operators. Remember this? So this field, what this field is precisely, will depend on exactly what operator you're constructing here. Because I could also have, for example, this. Okay? Or I could have this. Things like this. But as long as I have a quark and an antiquark, then this operator will be dual to some field whose details will depend on the operator, but this field will propagate. It will be a 7-7 string mode, propagating on the word volume of the 7 brains. Okay? This is very important. Mesons are supported on the brain probes. Okay? So globals can propagate everywhere, but the mesons live on the 7 brains. So now, once you know that, suppose that now you look for the spectrum of these guys. So you again write something like this, times h of r. Now we have to solve the equation of motion for this guy and look for normalizable and regular solutions. But this guy propagates on the 7 brains. And you see the 7 brains close off at the finite value of r. So again, I have to impose regular solutions here and normalizable solutions here. And those two conditions give me that the spectrum of mesons, this squared meson, now is again discrete. And in fact, it's gapped. OK? Is this clear so far? This is actually something that perhaps should be surprising to you. Because these quarks and antiquarks live in a theory that's not confining. N equals 4 super young Mills coupled to quarks is not a confining theory. Is this clear? OK? Nevertheless, that doesn't mean that you cannot have bound states. For example, quantum electrodynamics, okay, the theory of photons and electrons, is that a confining theory? No, it's not a confining theory. We see photons. Okay, they are not confined in blue ball, photon balls. Okay, and we see electrons. They are not confined in mesons. However, QED does have bound states. Okay, the atom, the hydrogen atom, is a bound state in QED. So this is an example in which the theory is very strongly coupled, unlike QED, but yet it's not confining, and yet it has bound states. The mesons only come in color singlets. Okay, the quarks and antiquarks are always bound together. Okay. So. In order, so I'm just going to finish by doing the simplest calculation which you can do, which is to compute the mass of the mesons. Okay? This looks like a very innocent calculation, but this was the first calculation of the meson spectrum in a strongly interacting four-dimensional field theory. Okay? If somebody gives you, here's a four-dimensional, strongly interacting quantum field theory, in principle, you have no idea how to compute the meson spectrum. It's a highly non-perturbative calculation. Okay? In this model, because you have the string description, you can actually do it. And that's what we are going to do. Okay? And it takes just 5 minutes. So all you need to know is the following. Remember I said that we have the seven brains are sitting at some distance, z equals l, from the origin, yes? So it turns out that if you look at the simplest type of meson, that has a field dual to it that corresponds to small fluctuations of this z coordinate, OK? So if you write z equals big Z equals capital L plus little z of x and r, this little z is precisely the field dual to this q q bar operator. I'm not proving this, but take my word for this. Okay? Is this clear? So then to find the spectrum of this type of mesons, all we have to do is write this little z as e to the ipx times h of r, find the equation of motion for this guy, substitute these answers into that equation. That will give us an equation for h, which will depend on the value of p squared. And then look at what type of solutions this h of r has. Okay? So where does the equation of motion come from? I shouldn't erase this. Let me erase over here. Remember that the equation of motion for the seven brain, I told you that you have to, this hypersurface is what you find when you look for the minimum area surface, and that's the one that spans the seven brain. If you now put little fluctuations, you can take the seven brain action. I hope everybody has seen this before. Has everybody seen this before? This is the Dirac-Bohr infield action for a seven brain. You see that it's, except for this dilaton coupling, if you set f to 0, this is just the square root of the determinant of the induced metric. Okay, it's a generalization of the Nambu-Goto action to a high-dimensional object. Okay, in our case, this f is not there. We're not including a gauge field. And the dilaton is constant because we are in a D3 brain background, and the dilaton is constant in that background. So for us, the action is simply the area. Okay? So the area is minimized when I set z equals l. If I now allow for a small fluctuation, a little z, and I expand this action to quadratic order in little z, I find the equation of motion by then taking the Euler-Lagrange equation. I find the equation of motion for little z. Yes? I'm not going to do it, but let me tell you what you get. And then from there, we'll get the meson mass. OK? So the equation that you get is r to the fourth over rho squared plus l squared. I'm doing this calculation because it's basically the only calculation I've done or I'm going to do all week. But it's very nice that with such a simple calculation, you can actually get the meson mass. So you get the Laplacian in the x, in the t and x directions, acting on little z, plus 1 over rho cubed, d rho, rho cubed, d rho z, equal 0. OK? So you see, you get a term with derivatives in the x directions, and a term with a derivative in the rho direction. Now, this Laplacian acting on z, when z is of this form, only acts on this bit. Okay? And nabla squared acting on this gives me minus p squared. Yes? So I'm going to replace this. Can I erase here? So this gives me minus p squared times z. And now you see I have an ordinary differential equation in rho. Now I can factor out e to the ipx, and I get an h here, h of rho and h of rho here. Is it clear what I did? I did separation of variables, and then I get an equation simply for this part. That depends, of course, on the eigenvalue for the other part. OK? Now, without solving this equation, we can determine the scale of the meson mass simply by changing to dimensionless coordinates here. OK? So if you now do the following change. Yeah. No, very good. What I meant by lambda squared here was, I guess I meant minus dt squared plus dx squared. Yeah. This factor here already takes into account the fact that you're in a curve magic. So, so now define rho bar, which is rho over L, it's dimensionless. H bar is H over L, and M bar is M R squared over L, where M is P squared. M squared is P squared. So this P squared is the value of the four-dimensional mass. And what I'm doing is rewriting this equation in terms of a dimensionless, in terms of dimensionless variables for all of them. So then this equation becomes m bar squared over rho bar squared plus 1 squared h bar plus 1 over rho bar cubed, rho bar cubed, d rho bar h bar equals. And now we are done, because now we are supposed to look for regular and normalizable solutions of this equation. Okay? But this equation, in this equation, everything is dimensionless. And the only parameter in this equation is this m bar squared. Okay? So we are supposed to determine for what values of this parameter the solution admits regular and normalizable solutions. The equation admits regular and normalizable solutions. But because everything is dimensionless, okay, that must happen for an m bar, which is going to be a pure number, a pure set of numbers. Okay, there's nothing dimension-full anymore. So this has to be a pure number of order 1. Is this clear? But if this is a pure number of order 1, going back here, I see that m has to be of order L over R squared from here. Okay, this is a pure number. So if I solve for M, I get that M goes like L over R squared. Yes? So if you now remember that L is proportional to the fourth mass, and you also remember what R squared is, you find that this goes like M cubed over square root of the fifth factor. And this is an important result. This is the scale that sets the meson mass, and in particular the gap in the meson spectrum, in this strongly coupled gauge theory. And you see that the meson mass is proportional to the fourth mass, but it's divided by the tooth coupling, or the square root of the tooth coupling, which is very large in our approximation. So this means that these mesons are very deeply bound. Is this clear? The mass of the meson is much, much smaller than the mass of the quark. Okay? This is not true in the hydrogen atom. Okay? The mass of the hydrogen atom is slightly smaller than the sum of the mass of the proton and the electron, because the binding energy is not very large compared to the masses. Here it's the opposite case. The binding energy is almost as large as the rest mass of the constituents. And that's why the bound state has a mass that's parametrically smaller than the constituent mass. Okay? And this is because this is a very strongly coupled gauge theory. Are there any questions about this? Exactly. Yeah, you can. Yes. then you have all the ingredients, because then you have confinement, mesons, quarks, etc. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's a very good model that, in addition to confinement, displays spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking, etc., etc. Yeah.
What if I wanted to match the proton?
That's much more complicated because
we don't have three quark constants.
No, but the proton at large n is not three quarks; it's nc quarks, right? So baryons have a mass at large n that goes like nc, because they are composed of nc quarks. Okay, and these are much more complicated to study. These are not little fluctuations of a d-brain. I can tell you what they are if you're interested, but I'm running out of time. So, yes. Well, here the quark mass is something given to you.
Yes.
I'm not addressing the origin
yes.
of the quark mass. Mm-hmm. That's a completely different story
yes,
that I'm happy to discuss, but not now because I'm really out of time and the next speaker is here. So, so any more questions? Okay, well, thank you, everybody. Then.